Last week we talked about, if you're here, the story of Jacob, wrestling with God. And one of the connections we made is this, that wrestling with God and wrestling with faith is written into the DNA and fabric of the Christian tradition. It's part of our spiritual lineage, our ancestry. And so knowing that, I think it calls us to boldly enter the ring of faith. And so we're drawing close to the end of our season here at Nexus. I think there's like 7 Sundays or 6 Sundays left, something like that. We're coming to a close. And what I want to do for this week and next week is help us wrestle through some particular challenges that I think are unique or somewhat unique to a faith community like ours. And I'll be honest, truth be told, I have been a critic here of certain elements of the Christian right quite often. And so part of what I want to focus on this morning is actually some challenges that I think face those of us who would consider ourselves belonging to more of the Christian left, or whatever you want to call that, whether you want to call it progressive Christianity or post-evangelical, post-fundamentalism, whatever you want to call it. What is it that those of us who are trying to find a fresh expression of faith, what is it that we need to wrestle with and grapple with? And so for us at Nexus, we, those of us who find faith hard, for the restless and the weary, the confused and the curious, the disillusioned, the disenfranchised, those about done with faith, what do we need to wrestle with? I've got 5 things I want to share with us this morning. Let's start here. I've come to think that one of the biggest struggles for those of us of faith today is something I would refer to as functional atheism. What do I mean by that? In short, I would say this. It means we live the majority of our lives as though God has no bearing on our days or how we live. And I think this is a challenge for all of us, but I think this is particularly challenging for some of us, and I want to try to paint a picture. This week, Kristen and I were just taking in a Jays game at home, chatting about our weeks, and she relayed a story about how this week she's known as the minister's wife, which isn't an easy thing at high school. She's known as the minister's wife and takes the brunt of any stupid thing that Christians in high school do. And she related the story of how a teacher came in this week, said, Watson, had some kid in class talking about how being gay is so wrong. What do you think of that? Or Watson had some kid going off about how the earth is 6,000 years old. What do you think about that? Or some Christian kid pulled down an anti-bullying sign in high school and said, what do you think about that? And she kind of gets all of this laid at her feet because she's the minister's wife. She said to me this week, she's like, I'm kind of done. Like, I hate being the person who has to answer for every stupid thing Christians do. I'm kind of tired of it. I'm tired of the identity of minister's wife. I'm tired of the identity as Christian. And here's the thing. My hunch is that Kristen's not alone. It's like being associated with the Christian faith today is anything but cool. And I think for many of us, it's actually embarrassing. The associations with being Christian, it can make us uncomfortable, and we're tired of being asked to defend people who share the same name of our faith, but seemingly few of our values. And the problem is that's just the start, actually, because besides being embarrassed of our faith, we might also be filled with pervasive doubts and questions about what we actually believe. And so you have like this potent cocktail that I think pushes many of us towards functional atheism. We're embarrassed by how culture sees Christianity. Combine that with wounds we've picked up in the church. Put on top of that our pervasive doubts and questions about faith, and it can almost feel irreconcilable. And what I think this often means within progressive Christian circles is this. In a room of us, what you actually have is a bunch of agnostics and functional atheists. And we want to keep faith at a distance. And so we think, well, I might not mind exploring faith. I don't mind sitting here for an hour. But during the rest of the week, I want to kind of have faith sit over there. And in many ways, I see us as sort of stuck in the loop of a certain story within Scripture I find fascinating. It's the story of Peter following Jesus from a distance. See, before Jesus' death, he was taken away and led to trial. And we get this interesting scene where Peter is embarrassed by what's going on because he totally thought what Jesus was about was not going to look like this. And he's scared about what he sees unfolding in front of him. And so he's afraid to be associated with Jesus. And in many ways, I think this story is our story. But when I read this story, consider it not so much as Jesus on trial, but the Christian faith on trial. And when you do that, this story starts to seem like a loop that we're continually stuck in. The wording is interesting to me. In Luke 22, it says, Peter followed at a distance. And there were some that had kindled the fire in the middle of the courtyard. They had sat down together. Peter sat down with them. A servant girl saw him seated there in the firelight. She looked closely at him and said, you were with him. You're part of that Jesus group, right? But he denied it. Well, woman, I don't know what you're talking about. A little later, someone else said, no, I swear I've seen you at Nexus before. You're one of them, right? No, not me, Peter replies. About an hour later, another asserted, no, certainly you were with him, for he's a Galilean. And Peter replied, I have no idea what you're talking about. And I love the imagery of this story and the way I think it speaks to the place that so many of us find ourselves today, embarrassed by faith, wounded by faith, having a plethora of doubts about faith. Many of us just want to keep our distance. We don't want to be associated with faith enough to in any way distinguish us from the prevailing values of our culture. It's like the time I was describing to somebody here. I said, at Nexus, we are unapologetically Christian. And this person said to me, fair enough, I'm apologetically Christian. And I loved it. I thought that was a brilliant line that captures, I think, what a lot of us feel and experience. We want to keep an arm's length from faith, and in that process, I think we end up becoming functional atheists. There becomes virtually no contrast between us and the prevailing, what we call, liberal humanism of our time and culture, and I'm not saying that as a knock on humanism, far from it. In fact, I think Christianity and humanism are like siblings. In fact, I think Charles Taylor's book, A Secular Age, makes a strong case. Humanism came out of Christianity. So it's not a knock on that. It's simply an observation on my part and something I think we need to wrestle with. We want to keep faith at an arm's length, and we become functional atheists. We become secular humanists who are in no way, in any distinguishable way, different from the prevailing attitudes of culture. And so one of the things I would say is this, one of the things we really need to wrestle with is this. Could we recover a sense of confidence in the distinct aspects of the Christian faith? We need to wrestle with finding our confidence again so that we can help rebuild and affirm what is unique and distinctive about being a Christian. Because our confidence is gone, and that's never a good thing. With my kids, they're trying to do spelling right now, and to be honest, they're quite awful. And they're trying to learn, and so we got the sight words going. And one of the things is they get frustrated easily and keep trying. It's okay, you have this in you. Be confident, you can do this. Or it's interesting to me the way sports commentators speak about sports. It's interesting to me during the Leafs playoffs. Countless times heard from commentators, it seems like Austin Matthews has lost his confidence in himself. And because of that, he can't play very well. I hear it in baseball as well. Last year, Kristen and I had the opportunity. We went down to Jay's game. We were six rows back. It was great seats from behind the enemy bench, the Texas Rangers. And Rougned Odor would come up to bat, and everybody in Toronto hates him because he fought with Jose Bautista, da-da-da-da. And the anguish behind the bench as he came up to go to bat, people started, you know, on the first inning, it was fairly mild, but boo, hiss, you suck. It was interesting to me, by the time like the ninth inning came around and people had more to drink, their insults became much more pointed, I would say, borderline inappropriate. But trying to, and I could hear these people talking, let's get in his head, let's break his confidence. And sure enough, he would strike out, and everyone's like, you suck. Just screaming at him, trying to get in his head. And you know, I think for many of us, that's how being a person of faith feels. There's so many voices screaming at us. External voices, internal voices, there's wounds from our past, there's cultural voices, the voice of doubt, the voice of cynicism. We internalize these messages, and I think it makes it very hard for us to live into the Christian faith. And I think one of the things we really need to wrestle is, can we recover a sense of confidence? A confidence that there is something of value and something distinctive about our faith which can and will bless the world if we would but reclaim it. But too many of us are shaken and timid, and we want to keep faith at arm's length. But in order to do that, I would say a second challenge presents itself, and it's this. For those of us who, whatever you want to call it, consider ourselves progressive, we have got to stop orbiting around the sun of evangelicalism. Some of the progressive expressions of Christianity today feel like they almost feed off of evangelicalism. And so if evangelical Christianity didn't exist, if there was no purity culture, if there was no such thing as a traditional view on marriage, if 81% of white evangelicals didn't vote for Trump, if there weren't people like Franklin Graham or Jerry Falwell Jr., I think a lot of Christians would have nothing to talk about, much less complain about. And the amount of energy I see online that's expended via podcasts and books and blogs devoted entirely to critiquing a certain movement. And I go, that's a lot of energy wasted. Could be used much more productively elsewhere. No one wants to be part of something that's always poking holes in something else. And so I think that's a real wrestle for us. Not only does progressive Christianity often lack anything distinctive, it has a parasitical relationship with evangelicalism that needs to stop. Third, like I said, not so fun, but a third challenge to wrestle with, and I think this is especially important right now, we have succumbed, I would say, to statism. Statism is this, the idea that the state, the government, is the best and most obvious way to change the world. It's the idea that the institution best suited to make the world better, the institution best suited to play judge and referee around social and moral affairs, is the government. And I think when we believe this, as many of us do, the temptation for Christians of all stripes is to operate primarily in the world by trying to take control of the government. And this is so patently obvious south of the border, but it's not just evangelicals who are vying constantly for influence of the state. Faith communities, I think, everywhere have been wholly taken in by the idea that the government is the only way, or perhaps the best way, to enact values and change. And I think what this means for our faith today is disturbing. Faith and politics have basically become the exact same thing. And it's a needed caution for all of us, because I would say this, when that happens, our allegiances get very murky very quickly. Daniel Rempel from Canadian Mennonite University says this. He says, an observation. Many conservative Christians are more interested in being conservative than being Christian, and many progressive Christians are more interested in being progressive than being Christian. Or Richard Beck says this, ask a conservative Christian how much daylight exists between their views on social and moral issues and the political right. Conversely, ask a liberal Christian how much daylight exists between their views on social and moral issues and the political left. By and large, on any given issue, there will be little to no daylight between the Christian right and the political right, or the Christian left and the political left. And his conclusion is this, what this means is that Christianity has been wholly captured and co-opted by empire. And I think he's right. For many of us, we've simply become the left version of the thing we so critique on the right. But it's the same philosophy. It's a Constantinian approach to faith, which is this, get political power and enact our values that way. And I think when this happens, the church almost becomes something of an abstraction. And please don't hear me wrong. I'm not saying don't vote. I'm not saying don't belong to a party. I'm not saying don't be political. I'm not saying don't be involved in the political process. But what I would say is Beck deserves a really close hearing here. I think our faith has been co-opted and captured by the state, by the empire, and by the lure and bright lights of power. The state has power. If we can just capture the state, we can enact our values. But Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. And the whole Old Testament is one long story about what happens when you mix faith with politics. Progressives hate the Old Testament because it's so violent, and it's a test case, a test study, you could say, of what happens when faith and politics get together. It's not good. Because it's not the state that loses its faith. I think the Christian faith makes a distinct and bold claim, an audacious claim. And it's this: the world is saved and redeemed through local communities like this one, gathering together under the banner of Christ and trying the difficult, hard work of simply getting along, loving one another, practicing kindness and care. Stanley Auerbach says the alternative to Constantinianism is not anti-Constantinianism, but rather to develop local forms of life that can sustain the necessary visibility of the church as an alternative to the world. I think when the state is the solution, what happens is we put our trust in that, and then everything becomes a battle. And when everything becomes a battle, virtually half of the population becomes the enemy or demonized, and if not half, at least the people who don't vote the same way as us. One of the distinctives of the Christian faith is we demonize no one ever. And when the state is the savior, that's really hard. And listen, I understand this is so difficult because there needs to be times when we speak towards issues that are difficult. There's a need for us to speak towards certain platforms that are dangerous. There's a need for us to speak truth to power. I know this is tough, and I'm not sure how you do that without demonizing people. I really don't know. But I would say this: from what I've seen online and social media, a lot of progressive Christians I know aren't even trying, not even trying to not demonize. And it's so embarrassing. That's not what it means to be a Christian on either side. And there's a wrestle here, a big wrestle. The state is not our savior. And we increasingly, I feel, are giving in to that. And, you know, it reminds me of a particular story in the Gospels, because as we continue to fracture, what ends up happening is I think we end up playing the role of the Pharisees. And Jesus tells this fascinating story of what happens when we feel ourselves to be on the right side. Pharisee and the tax collector. Jesus says this: to some who are confident of their own righteousness and look down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, and one was a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you, I'm not like the other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. And the tax collector stood at a distance. He wouldn't even look up to heaven, but he beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you, that man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. And I think what Jesus is getting at here is any condescending sorting of the world into saints and sinners, good guys, bad guys, us versus them, has no part in Jesus' movement. And the Pharisees, their tendency was to police boundaries around moral purity. Don't say the wrong thing. Don't do the wrong thing. We have moral purity boundaries everywhere. And I think Jesus is saying this condescending attitude of policing saints and sinners, it needs to be turned on its head. And then we see this with Jesus. Matthew 9, Jesus is reclined at the table. We've done a whole series on this story. And there were many tax collectors and sinners with him. And when the Pharisees saw this, they said, why does your teacher eat with them? When he heard it, he said, Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. I think Jesus demonstrates here the model of what church can be at its best, a local, concrete, actualized expression of hospitality that embraces those we deem unclean according to our own moral standards. But to do this, to pull this off, means investing heavily in the local church. And I think it speaks to another challenge many progressive Christians face, and it's this: we have a very casual approach to church. When I grew up, my church was in many ways so awful. Theologically, it was, in my mind, way off. Not to mention the sexual abuse and power abuse and, you know, all that stuff. But I've mentioned to you before, they had something right. And that was, everyone was invested. And it, of course, helped that we were there twice on Sundays and once on Wednesday night and every day at school and Friday nights at youth. I mean, it was us all the time. But they had something right. And I got to be honest, I miss it. I miss it. I miss the sense of, hey, we're all in this together for more than an hour on Sundays. We're in this together all the time. I think for many of us today, one of the things we need to wrestle with is we just have such a casual approach to church. We keep it at arm's length, and for good reason. It's embarrassing. We have doubts about what it stands for, and it's hurt us in the past. Beyond that, church feels boring and irrelevant, and on top of that, we're busy. We have kids to take to sports. And on top of that, many of us are introverted. Fair enough. Let me simply say this. If we surrender and give in to those ideas, then the church will not exist anymore going into the future. And the challenge is this. If we don't, all of us, invest heavily into the local church, it won't exist anymore. And the challenge is this. If we're going to revitalize the church's relevance, vitality, and potency, it has to happen with us investing heavily. And sometimes, to be honest, I can't help but think that the way a lot of progressive Christians talk, that they actually might want the demise of the church. The way a lot of progressives talk, it's almost like they would love to see the whole thing burn. And I find that personally offensive, because if you believe, as I do, in the church, then we're going to have to invest in it in order to rehabilitate it. And that's an incredibly difficult task. Trust me, I sit in a group with church planners who've been trying to do the same thing, similar things we're doing at Nexus here. Ask those people how hard it is to start a church that's trying to do something new and fresh. It's almost impossible. It's incredibly difficult, and for a lot of reasons, but particularly difficult because in North America, the reality is this: we're too busy, and we're distracted, and we're restless. And it brings us to the final challenge of the morning, the final challenge I want us to wrestle with, and it's this. One of the biggest cultural values we have is a fierce commitment to autonomy, independence, and consumerism. And these cultural values make it almost impossible to do church. We're the products of the West, and so we guardedly privilege our individualism over any sense of collectivism. And when that's the case, good night. It's hard to get people around the table of community. I would say this: trying to do church today feels a lot like trying to herd cats. And it's even more than just individualism, it's a consumerism mindset as well. We're swimming in the waters of a consumer culture, which means this: like it or not, our default position approaching church is that of a consumer. We approach church as if we're carrying a grocery list. Church is where we go to receive our religious goods and services. So we come with our list. Let's see, does it have preaching that I like and falls in line with my theological leanings? Does it have kind of music I like? Does it have the kind of singing I like? Kids programs I like? Are the people weird? Or are they somewhat manageable and can easily get along with? Does it have parking? And when we think like a consumer, what can happen is this. The thing that ends up binding us together is that we like it. We're here at this church or at another church because we like it. Maybe we like the sermons, or we like the music, or the programs, or the kids' ministries, or the faith statement, or lack of faith statement, whatever it is. When you think about it, though, liking something is such a weak foundation. If liking something is what binds us together, what happens when you stop liking it? What happens if you don't like what I'm saying this morning? What happens if you don't like the music? What happens if you don't like the kids' program? What happens when the going gets tough? What happens when there are wrongdoings in our community that need to be addressed? What happens when love gets really costly? What happens when we disagree vehemently about certain things? What happens then? I'm convinced the faith community needs to understand itself in the same way a good marriage should, which is this. At a certain point, marriage won't work if all it is about liking that person. There needs to be something more than liking your partner. Because the brilliance of marriage is this: the relationship is based on promise and commitment, not liking. And so when our partner does something we don't like, we don't think to ourselves, I'm out of here. We think, that kind of sucks, but I signed up for this and I made a promise and I made a commitment and we're going to work on this and learn to love each other through it. Because love is less about liking than it is about promising. And that requires a heavy commitment, a heavy investment to do that and be involved in a local church. To revitalize church, to make it work, to take a church like Nexus and move it from what it is to something even more meaningful, even more impactful, to take Nexus and make it a place that's truly doing the hard but necessary work of bringing vastly different people together under one roof in order to learn to love across differences, that needs heavy investment from all of us. And I know what you're thinking. Oh, crap, he hasn't talked about money this year. In fact, he hasn't done a sermon on money in 2 years. Oh, no, here we go. No, I'm not going to talk about money. That's not the goal. The goal is wrestling this morning. And the wrestle is this: as Western Christians, we prize our autonomy, independence, and our personal tastes far too much to find authentic Christian community. That's just a reality. And Western Christians, the reality is this: we are too busy, too exhausted, too consumeristic to ever really do church. And until we wrestle with that, we'll never find it. We won't have the time or the energy for Christian community, and we don't have the time or the energy for spiritual formation. We simply don't have it. We're not willing to make that investment. And I don't know what the answer is. I really don't. I don't know what the solution is. I don't have any great words of wisdom except to say this: we've got to wrestle with this hard. And so I think all of us need to learn, maybe one step going forward is maybe this: practice what Walter Brueggemann calls Sabbath as resistance. I've done a whole series on this in the past while not practicing it myself. So there you go. But it's worth revisiting, because Walter writes this: in our own contemporary context of the rat race of anxiety, the celebration of Sabbath is an act of both resistance and alternative. It is resistance because it's a visible insistence that our lives are not defined by the production and consumption of commodity goods. I'm not sure how to wrestle with the gods of autonomy, individualism, consumerism, but I think a healthy place to start is Sabbath, carving out the time to say no. Because until we say no, we can't say yes to investing ourselves heavily. And so unless we have practices in life that allow us to say no, we will increasingly be fueled by our individualistic and consumeristic anxieties. This year I made a commitment that I have faltered on a little bit, but it's been better than years before. Every June for the past few years at Nexus, I've got to the end of our season and just been like done. Like, if I had to do two more Sundays of teaching, I think I would have just passed out, just done. And what it felt like for me for the past few seasons was just going 7 days a week, out every night, go, go, go. And this year, just given a reality as a family, I thought, I have to say no. I am going to be done my work for the week by Friday at 5. And the worst part is, that didn't happen this week. But for most weeks this year, that's happened. And I've put away my work at 5 p.m. on Friday and said, I'm not going to think about that again until Sunday morning. I'm just not going to go there. And it's been so refreshing. And the end of the year is coming, and I'm like, I'm ready. I got energy. I still have energy. I think what happens for so many of us is we get caught up in all the stuff that needs to get done, and we're so exhausted. And so what church becomes is simply overload. When you hear someone like me say, hey, we need you to invest more, you go, oh God, please no. Please, nobody ask anything else from me. I can't handle any more. And I get it, but that has consequences down the line. Until we have the courage to say, no, no. I'm going to set aside a whole day and do absolutely nothing. I'm just going to enjoy the rhythms of rest. Until we can start with that, and that is a hell of a challenge right there, then I don't think we're going to be able to make room for a lot of these other things. So, awkward transition to the choir coming back up to close us with a song. But, five things. Can we find our confidence again in the distinctives of the Christian faith? Number two, can we please end our parasitical relationship with evangelicalism? Number three, can we find the imagination to believe the state is not the only or even the best way to make change in our world? Number four, can we please carve out the time, space, and energy to invest in this church? Number five, can we begin to push back on the gods of autonomy, independence, and consumerism? It won't be easy. And we're all going to leave this wrestling ring limping, I guarantee it. But may we all have the courage to at least get in the ring in the first place.